Please join me in Joshua chapter number 10. We have just finished the story of how the Gibeonites became servants of the tabernacle. They are the cutters of the wood, the carriers of the wood, the drawers and carriers of the water that's used in the tabernacle in great amounts every single day of the year. They have now become a protected people within the nation of Israel. But they also became targets. When the Gibeonites gave up their sovereign rights to the Israelis, their territory, while they will still live in it, becomes Israeli territory. And so the Israelis now have control of pretty much the east-west highway from the Jordan to the Med that goes past Bethel and Ai and then down into the Gibeonite territory. The Canaanites to the south of there had already been making plans to engage the Israeli beachhead that has been established. But now they have decided they should attack the Gibeonite territory, punish those traitor Gibeonites, and retake that part of Canaan back into Canaanite control to deprive the Israelis of that extension of their beachhead. And the head of this Canaanite Southern Alliance has an interesting name. We're in Joshua chapter 10, verse 1 says, "As soon as Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard," and then we'll talk about what he heard in a little bit. You may remember back in the time of Abraham, many hundreds of years previous, there was a king over Salem, which is the most ancient name for Jerusalem, named Melchizedek. The Zedek in both names is the same. It means righteousness. Now, Melchi just meant king. Adoni means Lord. It is a synonym for king. And so I will suggest very strongly to you that the name Adoni-Zedek is a slight variation of Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, that he might in fact be a direct descendant of Melchizedek, but he certainly has the same position as Melchizedek, but he doesn't have the faith of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was also the priest of God Most High. He was one of those interesting pockets of true faith that existed whenever Abraham arrived as a new believer in the Promised Land way back at that time. So what we see here is a big change in the centuries from Jerusalem being led by a man of faith to now being led by a man who hates the faith, that is, the belief in the one true and living God that Melchizedek actually served as priest for. So as soon as this guy, Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had captured Ai and had devoted it to destruction, doing to Ai and its king as he'd done to Jericho and its king. So talking about the establishment of the beachhead, that taking of Jericho down by the crossing point for the Jordan, and then coming up to Ai which is at a crossroad for the east-west, north-south roads, and taking it. The big thing that he heard about next was how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. So they were allies of the Israelis. And so the Israelis now had free access to the entirety of the east-west road. And so Adonai Zedek feared greatly. And the reason he did was not just simply because Israel had control of that prime route, it was also that Gibeon just rolled over for them. Because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities. Now that's a reference to the connection of the Canaanites to Egypt. They had a relationship with the Egyptians in years past, and those cities paid tribute to Egypt and received benefits from that tribute, such as trade benefits and military protection benefits. Now, all of that went out the window when the plagues under Moses broke the Egyptian economy and the crossing of the Red Sea and the drowning of the Egyptian chariot forces broke the military of the Egyptians. That also broke the spirit of leadership in Egypt. The king who followed the king of the Exodus, or at least within a very short period of time, is known to us, Akhenaten, as a man who began to withdraw interest of Egypt anywhere except at Egypt. Became very isolationist. He also became very monotheistic. That's one of the things that he's really known for. He even moved his capital city to a brand new site that was devoted to a one God concept. And that site, we know it now as Amarna, and we have letters in that have been found in the record houses and storage facilities at Amarna, where the kings in Canaan were writing to the Egyptians during the period of Joshua and basically saying, we're under attack, you've got to come and protect us. And Egypt wouldn't come because they'd withdrawn from that sort of relationship with the Canaanites. So back to our text, that is what Adoni Zedek is thinking about, is that Gibeon was one of the really strong cities of Canaan in the previous period. It was like one of the royal cities. It was greater than Ai was, and all the Gibeonites were warriors. And yet they just rolled over and let the Israelis have that territory. And so he does what you would expect. He makes an alliance of multiple cities. He sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, to Piram, king of Yarmut, to Zaphia, king of Lachish, to Debir, king of Eglon. Now, all these cities are to the south and southwest of Jerusalem. I think we're within one day's walk to all of these cities. So about 30 miles is the farthest one away. He said, come up to me, help me. Let us strike Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the people of Israel. So he asked them to come and join him on a military punishment campaign against the Gibeonites and to take that territory over for their alliance and use that as their beachhead their front line against the Israelis, which they'd already planned on doing anyway. So the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered their forces and went up with all their armies and encamped against Gibeon and made war against it. Now the Gibeonites, there's no way in the world they could take on a five-city alliance. And so the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp in Gilgal. So they, as soon as they see this military activity happening nearby, they immediately put out a call for protection, because that would have been one of the agreements or points of agreement in their covenant, that the Gibeonites will be protected by the Israeli army. So their message is, don't relax your hand from your servants. Come up to help us quickly. Save us. Help us, for all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the hill country are gathered against us. So our previous story, I think, happened during the non-military campaigning season. So we'll just call it the late fall and winter of the first year of the Israelis being in the Promised Land. We are now in the spring of the second year of the Israelis being in the Promised Land. Joshua had not yet started his military campaign, but once he hears that his protected Gibeonites are in trouble, he musters his forces. So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, all the mighty men of valor. And he who is said to Joshua, so Joshua checks in with God, that's very good. Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not a man of them shall stand before you. So you don't need to worry about this military force. You will roll over them. So Joshua came upon them suddenly, having marched up all night from Gilgal. And he who has threw them into a panic before Israel. We'll actually see this quite often in descriptions of God's supernatural fight on behalf of the Israeli people, that he will cause the enemy to get into a blind panic. And that then allows the Israelis to just have the upper hand from the beginning of the engagement. And this is described in other places, how one of the Israelis will put 1,000 to flight and 10 will put 10,000 to flight, that sort of thing. So he struck them with a great blow at Gibeon, and then he chased them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon. Now, Beth-horon is to the north and west of Gibeon, just a little ways, but it is part of that valley that Gibeon was at the head of, one of the two valleys that Gibeon is at the head of. It's the Aijalian, is how we usually say it, valley. It goes past Beth-horon and then down onto the plain of the Mediterranean. That valley was part of the Gibeonite territory. Whenever they attack these Amorites, the Amorites panic and run off to the northwest and start running down this valley toward the plain of the Med. Once they get to the plain, they hang a hard left or south and start running back to their hill country. And so the Israelis are chasing them the whole way. So they're striking them down as far as Azekah. I've been to Azekah. It's the hill that overlooks the entry point of the Elah Valley, where David and Goliath had their standoff. The hill that Azekah stands on is kind of the entry point into the Ila Valley from the plain of the Jordan. Excuse me, the plain of the Mediterranean. So this is where they started going into what they thought was their safe zone. But the Israelis are still hot on their trail, killing them as they go. And so they take them as far as Azekah and Makeda. We don't know exactly where Makeda is. We know it must be farther into that hill country to the south from Azekah. And there's some sites in there that are candidates for this. And as they fled before Israel, while they were going down the ascent of Beth Horon, so that's back to the beginning of this, that valley that descends from Gibeon, past Beth Horon, down to the Mediterranean plain. So right at the beginning of that valley. While they were running, he who is threw down large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. So what we just described, the route of the route, the retreat path, is a good day's run. But the whole time they're trying to run away, God is pelting them with stones. The Israelis are not getting hit. Only the retreating Amorites are being hit for several hours as this strategic withdrawal. Nah, it's not. It's a rout. It's a full-blown retreat. So the whole time that's happening, the hours that are going by here, God is just slamming them with stones. Now, the English translators typically assume that these are hailstones. That is, that it's ice balls coming down out of the sky. And we certainly see that in other places. But it just says stones from out of the sky. It could actually be that God is pummeling these guys with meteorite strikes. But either way, it's heavy artillery from heaven. And a lot of them die. In fact, the author of the book of Joshua, which I believe certainly is a prophet, and I suspect might actually be Phinehas, the next high priest, says this: there were more who died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword. So there were more casualties from God's artillery than from actual Israeli military. But then we have this amazing part of the story. At that time, Joshua spoke to He Who Is in the day when He Who Is gave the Amorites over to the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand still at Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon." And then the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, until the nations took vengeance on their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Yasher? Now, Yasher, the Hebrew name here, is actually related to Yesharon that we've seen as a pet name for Israel, the upright one. So this is the book or the scroll of the upright. And some people think, well, does that mean we have a book that's missing? I don't know that we could say it was missing. It certainly existed at the time that Joshua, the book, was written down. It just was not considered inspired by itself, and therefore ends up not being copied as often. And so we don't have extant copies of it today. The sun stopped in the midst of heaven and did not hurry to set for about a whole day. Now, I see some people say 24 hours. Not necessarily. I think we could be just simply talking about daylight hours. And so 12 hours or so. There has been no day like it before or since, when he who is heeded the voice of a man, for he who is fought for Israel. So for all intents and purposes, God listened to Joshua's request for extra time to chase these people down and eradicate them before they could get to their home bases, which are about a day's journey away. See, if the battle started in the morning, then night would have fallen before they could have gotten to all these guys on the road and taken them out. So Joshua asks for more daylight, and God gives it to him. And so it is as if the sun is frozen in the sky above Gibeon. Sounds like it's like at noontime, right above Gibeon. And the moon is down to the west, hovering over the valley of Ajalon. So apparently the moon is on its way to setting. And that tells us that it's probably in the second half of a month. Now, do I believe that God stopped the rotation of the earth? He could. Wouldn't that cause all sorts of disastrous effects? Not if God was using his supernatural power, no. But it could be that God didn't even have to mess with anything like that. We know that you can reflect light or refract light through the atmosphere. And so I've actually had people suggest in commentaries that God just simply bent the light source image so that the Israelis got the effect of more sunlight for the time that they needed. But either way, it's a miracle. God wanted them to have more time. They got more time. And we'll leave it at that. And so, it's a great victory. So Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. Now, they don't return there just yet. There's still a little bit more information about the retreat. Verse 16, these five kings fled and hid themselves in the cave at Makkedah. And it was told to Joshua, the five kings have been found. They've hidden themselves in the cave at Makkedah. Joshua said, roll large stones against the mouth of the cave. Set men by it to guard them. But don't stay there yourselves. Pursue your enemies. Attack the rear guard. Do not let them enter their cities, for he who is your God has given them into your hand. So you can tell from this that the rout was still happening. The Amorites were still trying to run away. The Israelis were still hot on their heel. God was still pummeling them with stones from the sky. And the light was still supernaturally available for them to do this. And Joshua says, don't stop and try to worry about those kings hiding in that cave. Just lock them in there with a big stone, put a guard on the site. We'll come back to them later. Let's get the stragglers taken care of. Verse 20, when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished striking them with a great blow until they were wiped out, and when the remnant that remained of them had entered into the fortified cities, so a few of them did get away, then all the people returned safe to Joshua at the camp at Makkedah. Not a man moved his tongue against any of the people of Israel. Now, I don't know what the idiom is about that. I wonder whether or not it somehow is a reference to there's no casualties. Verse 22. Then Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave, bring those five kings out to me from the cave. And they did so. And they brought those five kings out to him from the cave, the king of Jerusalem, king of Hebron, king of Yarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon. And when they brought those kings out to Joshua, Joshua summoned all the men of Israel and said to the chiefs of men of war who had gone with him, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. And so they came near and put their feet on their necks. We actually have imagery of this being done in the Middle East in ancient times as a symbol of the victor over the person conquered, the victim. The loser with the winner having his foot on the neck. So Joshua said to these leaders, this is the Sanhedrin, "Do not be afraid or dismayed. Be strong and courageous, for thus he who is will do to all your enemies against whom you fight." So he uses this as a teaching moment. Just like God has helped us in a matter of one day defeat the combined might of five city-states, he's going to help us take the entire country. "For thus he who is will do to all the enemies against whom you fight." Then afterward, Joshua struck them, put them to death. He hanged them on five trees, and they hung on the trees until evening. Now that's probably the next day after the fight. That's when they do the king execution ceremony. And after they've killed them, they display their bodies. But as the sun is setting, they take their bodies down because that's according to the law. "But at the time of the going down of the sun, Joshua commanded, they took them down from the trees, threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves, and then they set large stones against the mouth of the cave, which remain to this very day. And as for Makkada, Joshua captured it on that day, struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He devoted it to destruction, every person in it. He left none remaining. He did to the king of Makkada just as he'd done to the king of Jericho." And so now Joshua begins the southern Canaan campaign, taking all of these cities and these territories as Israeli allotted inheritance.